Ayatollah Khamenei says the U.S. is complicit in the recent terrorist attack on a shrine in Shiraz because of its role in creating Daesh. Several regional actors as well as non-regional players get together in Jordan for a discussion of Iraq's security issues. Also ahead, the United States flies its strategic bombers and stealth fighters to South Korea following the North's latest ballistic missile tests. Our top story, Iran's Islamic Revolution leader says the United States was behind the deadly October attack on a holy shrine in southern Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei says the U.S. is an accomplice to the crime as Washington was the main sponsor and creator of Daesh, a terrorist group which claimed the attack. The leader made the comments during a meeting with the families of the victims. He said killing pilgrims is quite different from other acts of terror and brings further disgrace on the enemy. Ayatollah Khamenei described those behind this terrorist act as liars and hypocrites. He said they claim to be advocates of human rights, but in practice, they create dangerous terrorist groups. The terrorist attack on Shiraz Shrine in the city of Shiraz left 13 pilgrims, including a young boy, dead. Medical negligence in Israeli jails has taken the life of another Palestinian inmate. Our correspondent, Mona Kandil, says the victim was suffering from serious health conditions before he lost his life.
We are speaking about Nasser Ahmed. This Palestinian prisoner and the leader of the Fatah's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, he was arrested by the Israeli forces in 2010, and he received five life sentences behind bars, plus 50 years as well. He was arrested by the Israeli forces several times before 2002. The Israelis had accused Nasser Abu Ahmed of killing a number of Israeli soldiers during the incursions that taken place in Ramallah. What happened is that Nasser Abu Ahmed was diagnosed as a cancer-stricken prisoner, and the Israeli prison authorities had refused to release him upon calls by the by his family and his mother, as well as by the Palestinian Authority and the different resistance groups. Instead, and according to doctors, the result of the tumor in his head was a direct result that the Israeli jailers or the Israeli authorities were not giving Nasser Abu Ahmed the appropriate medication.
Palestinian groups have reacted to the death of Nasser Abu Ahmed, a senior commander of the Fatah movement in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. The Fatah says such incidents expose the fascist nature of Israel in its treatment of Palestinian prisoners. It says the regime is directly responsible for Abu Ahmed's death, and Palestinian resistance movements have also called for stronger resistance against Israel's policy of medical negligence toward Palestinian inmates. Hamas has also slammed Israel for what it called the regime's terrorist behavior toward Palestinians. A general strike has also been announced in Ramallah in reaction to the Palestinians' death. Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. Delegations are arriving in Jordan ahead of the Baghdad 2 summit, which is aimed at easing tensions in the region, particularly in Iraq. Senior officials from key regional players, including Iran and Saudi Arabia, will take part in the summit. They are being joined by leaders from some European countries, including the French president. The event is the second round of the Baghdad Conference for Cooperation and Partnership, which was held in Iraq last year. Iran is being represented by Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the conference. According to the French presidency, the event aims to provide support for the stability, security, and prosperity of Iraq. The Arab country has been mired in political tensions and economic woes in recent years. So joining us is Leif Ma'rouf, activist and political commentator from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and also Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome. Leif, if I could start with you. How can you start speaking about security or stability in Iraq when there is an occupation? The country is under occupation. An occupation that has killed two men, that saved the country from terrorism, and an occupation that Iraqi officials accuse of creating instability and riots in Iraq, especially in southern Iraq, similar to the riots that we have seen in Iran over the past few weeks?
Of course, that's a big question. Iraq is under occupation still. The actual purpose of the summit that was started last year, as you mentioned earlier in your briefing at the beginning of this, was an attempt by France, the soft face of imperialism, to rearrange some of the relations that are there between the countries around Iraq in service of limiting some of the confrontations that are happening. The first summit was held in Baghdad, and it was under the auspices of, at the time, Prime Minister al-Kadhimi, who was more aligned with the United States. At that time, Iran was not invited, and the first step that was to get all the pro-US countries around Iraq, the Gulf countries and Jordan and Egypt, to align their vision of how they want to approach Iran. And today, this summit in the Dead Sea will be basically about that now the relationship between this bloc that the French and the Americans created to Iran. Of course, now we have a new prime minister of Iraq, Prime Minister al-Sudani, who is more balanced and less of a tool of the United States. I wonder what's going to come out of this summit beyond than just speeches.
Well, it's being described, Marcus, as a regional, as a summit aimed at easing tensions in the region, with particular focus on Iraq. But what about Syria, for example?
I must say, first of all, that I am cynical towards conferences organized in the Middle East by countries other than Syria and Iran. Because with the exception of Syria and Iran, all other countries in West Asia are controlled with varying degrees by Western powers. If we take Jordan, for example, which is hosting the conference, in this country, Britain has historic influence stemming back to the 1920s, when Britain effectively created what was then known as Transjordan. And ever since after the Second World War, the all-powerful British and Jordanian royal families maintain exceptionally close relations with one another. So again, I'm very cynical towards this conference, which has been labelled for partnership and cooperation. Well, colourful words which have no bearing, no meaning in practice. And why is Syria absent? Again, because Syria is an independent sovereign country, and the Syrian people defeated a major objective of Western powers and regional powers such as Turkey and Saudi Arabia when the aforementioned powers tried to overthrow the Syrian government and replace it with a pro-Western puppet government in Damascus. That is why I attach no importance to this conference. If we take another country such as Iraq, Iraq in the northern part of the country is being used by the Americans and the British as a staging ground for attempting to create instability in Iran by training terrorists there and then deploying these terrorists across the border into Iran. So whilst I understand the reason as to why the Iranian government is sending a representative to this conference in Jordan, namely its foreign minister, in practice, nothing will be achieved because West Asia, again, with the exception of Iran and Syria, is controlled by Western powers. And Western powers have created the volatility that the Middle East is known for. And by organizing this conference, Western powers and their subjects in the Middle East can simply say to the rest of the world that we care for the Middle East. We are trying to create peace and harmony in the Middle East. In reality,
right,
those countries are the single source of instability in the region.
Right, and I suppose the question is, and I believe we have lost Laith Ma'ruf, we'll try and get him back as soon as possible. The question is, Marcus, do they care for the countries in West Asia, or as they like to refer to it as the Middle East? Do they? I mean, is there a conference, is there a summit where we don't see Emmanuel Macron? And he's just been in Washington speaking to President Biden, so there's no doubt. You know, you can put two and two together that Biden, the U.S., is also involved in this conference.
Do the Americans, the British, and the French care for the well-being of people across West Asia? Well, let's judge them by their actions. As a result of Western sanctions on Iraq, untold numbers of Iraqi men, women, and children died painful deaths. When Madeleine Albright was asked whether the deaths of untold Iraqi children were worth the price of American sanctions, she responded by saying yes. When the Western powers invaded Iraq in 2003, more than 1 million Iraqi civilians would subsequently die. As a result of Western powers supporting terrorist groups in Syria, such as ISIS and Al-Qaeda, again, hundreds of thousands of Syrian men, women, and children died and died painful and violent deaths. As a result of America and Britain's war on the people of Yemen through Saudi Arabia, over 400,000 Yemeni men, women, and children have died and
right.
have died
the
violent
list is,
deaths. So they
the
do
list
not
is endless,
care
right.
the people.
Yeah. Let me thank our guests. I'm afraid we have run out of time. Laith Ma'ruf, activist and political commentator, joining us from Beirut. And Marcus, thank you very much indeed. Marcus Papadopoulos is a historian, political analyst, and author from London. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review. All right, tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula. The United States has reportedly deployed B-52 bombers and F-22 fighters for joint drills with South Korea. The deployments are the first since May 2018. They come days after Pyongyang launched two mid-range ballistic missiles. North Korea says its recent slew of missile tests are a response to the growing presence of the U.S. in the region and its joint military drills with South Korea and Japan. Meanwhile, North Korea has denounced Japan's new security strategy after it unveiled its biggest military buildup since World War II. Pyongyang says Tokyo's talk of the right to preemptive strikes represents a new aggression policy. North Korea is also warning of practical countermeasures. Right, our correspondent Frank Smith earlier joined us from Seoul. He says the deployment of U.S. bombers is rooted in South Korea's attempt to bring more strategic weapons to the region.
This follows South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's determination to bring more so-called strategic assets. Those are American weapons that can potentially deliver nuclear weapons. This also comes with a stronger commitment to so-called extended deterrence. That's the U.S. nuclear umbrella, in which the U.S. promises essentially to use any weapons at its disposal, including nuclear weapons, to defend its allies around the world, and in this case, South Korea and Japan. Unfortunately, what we really have here is an arms race now developing, with Korea spending more money on weapons, generally U.S. weapons. Japan just announcing that it's going to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP, including developing counter-strike capabilities to respond to what it perceives as a North Korean threat.
UK nurses go on strike today in their second industrial action in less than a week over the economic hardships they're facing. Up to 100,000 nurses walk out from their jobs in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. They want better pay rises to be able to cope with soaring inflation. That's after the government offered raises of more, roughly 4 to 5%. The striking nurses are just a fraction of public and private sector workers taking industrial action over pay and working conditions. Ambulance workers, including paramedics and call handlers, are set to strike on Wednesday as well. Britons are grappling with a cost-of-living crisis worsened by decades-high inflation. The Russian president says the situation in four Ukrainian regions Russia has annexed is extremely difficult. Vladimir Putin ordered the security services to ensure the safety of people living in those areas. He also instructed the agencies to step up surveillance to protect borders of the region and combat new threats. Putin's comments come as Ukraine renewed calls for more weapons amid strikes against its energy infrastructure and allegations that Belarus could join Russia in the war. Both Belarus and Russia have denied the allegations. Moscow also says the attacks on Ukraine's energy facilities are a response to the country's strikes on Russian power lines. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the future of Brazil with Brazilian author and journalist Pepe Escobar. But first, this brief analysis.
The events surrounding the recent presidential elections in Brazil could have been taken from the plot of a political thriller novel or a movie. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva emerged victorious in the second round of the elections, beating incumbent Jair Bolsonaro by a relatively small margin of 2 million votes in a nation of over 215 million people. He begins his third non-consecutive term as president of Latin America's largest nation, following years of judicial prosecution and incarceration on charges of corruption, charges which he eventually vacated by Brazil's highest court, allowing Lula da Silva to participate in the elections as the head of a multi-party coalition challenging right-wing incumbent Bolsonaro. These elections once again put on display the deep social and cultural divisions that exist in Brazil, rooted in its colonial history and the era of the U.S.-backed military dictatorship, which ruled the country from 1964 to 1985. Brazil is one of the founders of BRICS, accomplishing this with Russia, India, and China during the first period of Lula da Silva's presidency in the early 20th century as an important international organization challenging U.S. hegemony. Brazil is at a historic and strategic crossroads where it is on the one hand a key nation in the emerging new multipolar world, and on the other hand, the most important country in Latin America in which military and traditional economic elites have deep relations with U.S. security organizations who continue to wield influence in Brazil through these elites and who will do anything to prevent Brazil from being a fully sovereign nation outside of the U.S. orbit. The next 4 years of the Lula da Silva presidency will be interesting to see in terms of the level that Brazil is able to assert its full sovereignty in global affairs contrary to U.S. pressures, and domestically, to what extent the economic situation regarding the tens of millions of people who live in poverty and the devastation left behind by the COVID pandemic can be alleviated.
Pepe Escobar, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You know, Salam, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure, our pleasure. You know, this is very good. We were really hoping to do a program on Brazil, particularly after the elections, and we were hoping it to do it with you. We always try to, when we're doing a subject, a country, we always try to find a person who's from that country to talk about the issues because, you know, it's a lot of the problems that exist in the media, in the global media today, is countries being talked about as opposed to the people from those own countries talking about themselves. And, of course, since our program is Insight, you know, we always gain a deeper insight of the country when you speak to somebody who's really from that country and knows that country and has lived the history of that country. So we're very happy to have you on our program today. You wrote a very interesting article in Asia Times following the election of Lula, of President Lula, President-elect Lula, and the following elections. And in this, it was a short piece, but there was a lot of interesting little tidbits, a lot of interesting points, which, of course, you know, you didn't have the opportunity to get into them in the article. But I think it's a good place for us to start our conversation and see where we can go. And our goal is to really understand Brazil on a deeper level. This is always what we try to do in this program. You talked about, for example, that there are two Lulas. There's the domestic Lula and there's the international Lula. And you also talked about the historic context, or you made references, you didn't really get into it too deeply, about the historic context of what we're seeing happening in Brazil in the last maybe 20 years. Mm-hmm. And where I want to start with you is we need to go back in history, look at the fact that you talk about that Jair Bolsonaro, who was the president, who was the controversial president, as we know, in terms of a lot of the policies that he made, particularly as it related to COVID, but also his very, you know, enthusiastic support for Trump, his very enthusiastic support for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about not Bolsonaro as a person, but the Project Bolsonaro, which has been something that you talk about the military in Brazil mm-hmm. having this project going on ever since you had Lula become the president in the early 21st century for the first time, a left-wing president becoming the president of Brazil for the first time since the early 60s, before the military coup. And I would just like to mention for our audience who don't know that there was a Brazil, the Brazil you grew up in, was the Brazil of a military dictatorship from 1964 mm-hmm. to 1985. So before we get into Lula and what's going to happen now and what the elections are, let's start with this idea that that there is a Bolsonaro project, that there is maybe a deep state, maybe the power of the military is still very much real and alive, and their connections with the Americans and with the CIA, more than what we would think if we look at this kind of very cliche image of Brazil, you know, with soccer and Copacabana and everybody mm-hmm. having fun and being friendly. So if you could please get us started with giving us your insight about this part of Brazil.
Well, it's a wide-ranging question, and it's going to be very hard to put it in 5 minutes, but I'll try my best. This is a Hollywood trick. Explain the plot of the movie in 25 words.
Exactly.
So I'm going to use a few more to try to explain exactly. a very convoluted plot. Okay, we have to start in terms of modern Brazilian history. The most important fact is Brazil was a military dictatorship from 1964 to roughly 1985-86. That's a long, long time. It was one of the most sophisticated military dictatorships in the global south. Mm-hmm. It was not as bloody as in Argentina or in Chile because mm-hmm. it was much more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was a brainwashing of most of the Brazilian population because the military were selling the myth of the Brazilian miracle, which mm-hmm. happened to be economically a miracle, especially during the 70s when there was still low oil prices, etc. After the oil shock, of course, everything started to go down little by little. And in the 80s, they were completely lost and they knew that they couldn't stay in power anymore without any justification whatsoever. So they engineered a transition towards democracy, which in the words of the military generals who were still ruling Brazil, was slow, gradual, and very secure. This is their own mantra for mm-hmm. this transition towards democracy. And of course, the deal that they made essentially with the Brazilian politicians and ruling elites essentially is, okay, everything that happened these past 20 years, you don't touch it. This means you don't touch us. So that was the unspoken agreement between Brazilian elites, the politicians that they appointed, of course, mm-hmm. and the guys who would lead this transition, this this transition towards democracy. And of course, the military would be in the background, but monitoring the situation. In this interregnum, after the post-military dictatorship years, starting in the 80s, and especially in the 90s, we have, of course, when Brazilian inflation was exploding to a level that even people in Iran and all across the global south cannot even imagine, something mm-hmm. like 3,000% a mm-hmm. year, which is something absolutely unimaginable.
Right.
Something had to be done. That's when the Real plan mm-hmm. came up, which was basically a parity of the new Brazilian currency, which was called the Real at the time, and the US dollar, 1-to-1. And so it was a restart of the Brazilian economy. It worked at the time because the bankers who coordinated the plan and the president at the time, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, sociologist, mm-hmm. They were completely protected by Wall Street, the international financial system, and Washington. They considered Cardoso one of them. Cardoso had a very close relationship with Bill Clinton, for that matter. And right. all the bankers, they had studied in American universities, all of them, right. with no exception. You know, so it was easy. So it was a seamless transition. And at the time, that was the second part of the 90s, especially. Brazil was a sort of darling internationally because they were following the Washington consensus to the letter. With, and of course, in terms of the internal situation, not much had changed. Mm-hmm. But then Lula, finally, Lula tried to become president at least three times. He lost three elections. Mm-hmm. But finally, in 2002, he was elected. But of course, to rule, he had to make a lot of concessions to whom? The Washington consensus, Wall Street, international financial system, etc. But he had some margin of maneuver at the time. Don't forget that at the time, the empire was completely preoccupied or obsessed by its own designated war on terror, which was more like a war of terror, right?
Exactly.
And Lula, just to give an idea to all of you, Lula came to power 2 months before the invasion, the bombing and invasion of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in his first years, he had more or less, he could do something in terms of social programs, eradication of poverty, sustainable development, bringing millions of people out from being excluded from the system to becoming at least lower middle class, if not middle class, you know.
Right.
So this happened during, especially the first and the beginning of the second Lula terms. Lula was in power from 2002 to 2010. We've been talking about what? Less than 30 years. Brazil was a military dictatorship, was a failed economy, was a darling of the international system, and it became a model to the global south in terms of sustainable development.
Right.
So these were four major different phases in a matter of only 40, 50 years, you know. So now, and that will bring us to what Lula is inheriting now, which is a completely different situation compared to when he first came to power in 2003, 20 years ago.
Okay, so it's very interesting, Pepe. You were saying that we had this period in the first period where Lula was ruling, where you had actually very real social development, poverty alleviation. You had jobs being created. Basically, things that you would expect in a very wealthy, rich country such as Brazil, with all the resources that it has. A government who is not necessarily even very communist or Marxist or very radical.
Not at all. Yeah.
Right. You're saying that basically he was able to sort of get this coalition going where he had to have people maybe with him who are a little bit more, how should we say, center-right or center.
Yeah.
But the result was that there was real change for a lot of the poor people in Brazil. It wasn't just, you know, something that was on paper. They really felt it. And then I want to go back to this idea that, like you said, the military is in the background. There's always somebody watching. There's always this point at some point where you can't really cross that line. And, you know, we see then the things that happened in terms of him being imprisoned and those issues, and also what happened with his successor, which was Dilma Rousseff, is if it was, for example, in a country like Turkey, you would call it a soft coup. You would call it You would call it, you know, as you know, in Turkey, they always have these. They have hard coups and they have soft coups.
Exactly.
Which, you know, when Erbakan became the prime minister following the Cold War in Turkey, he was Islamist. He came to Iran. And then, you know, immediately you had, letters being sent by the military and he was removed. So can we really say that what happened following the Lula era and then later with his successor, Dilma Rousseff, was in a way a kind of a soft coup?
No, it was a hardcore coup.
Okay, please go ahead.
Disguised as a soft coup.
Right.
And for many people, there was no coup at all. That's even more worrying because for, we could say almost half of Brazilian population, oh, there was never a coup. He was corrupt. He had to go to jail. Dilma was corrupt as well. And that's terrible because this is where we get to the massive fake news and disinformation campaign installing a cognitive dissonance among millions of Brazilians on everything that happened during the car wash corruption investigation, which was completely manipulated by, we can say, Brazilian fifth columnists, of course, but manipulated in the background by the Americans. Now we all know how it started, which was by the end of the Lula era. It started almost the minute Dilma Rousseff was elected as president in 2010. And the American campaign started in 2010 itself. And this is something that we later learned via WikiLeaks cables.
Please tell us more.
Exactly. WikiLeaks revealed, I think by 2015, years later, WikiLeaks revealed how the Americans started to spy on key institutional instances in Brasilia, Petrobras, everything tied to Petrobras, the Brazilian oil gas giant, one of the top energy companies in the world, and even the personal phone of President Dilma Rousseff.
Right.
All that is known, documented. Everybody knows it since WikiLeaks first revealed it. So this was a concerted campaign by CIA, FBI, State Department, Department of Justice, Treasury, etc., because they knew, now maybe we have a wink link over there. Lula is not in power anymore.
Right.
So first we go after Dilma, and then we go after Lula. For that, we need a lawfare mechanism.
Exactly.
And that's where the car wash investigation.
Right. Just to explain for our audience, lawfare is when they use the legal system to attack, to
attack, demonize, and eventually imprison and put in jail.
It looks like a legal process that's very innocent.
It looks like a legal process.
But the reality is it's persecution in the worst case. In the worst sense.
Absolutely, with the bogus evidence or no evidence at all, with the co-option of mainstream media, which in Brazil was massive. The whole mainstream media was against Dilma, and then let's put Lula in jail. Everybody, especially the largest media conglomerate in Brazil, Globo, which owns Globo TV, which is probably the fourth largest, most powerful TV network on the planet after the three Americans, you know. Mm-hmm. So they have enormous power in the deep recesses of Brazil. Like, you know, they reach corners of the Amazon jungle that you don't even know they exist. But everybody's tuned to the global newscast at 8 o'clock every night, you know, that kind of stuff. Right. So you have a corrupted Congress, corrupted judiciary, corrupted media, corrupted politicians, and in the background, of course, exercising plausible deniability always, the Americans. The whole American judicial lawfare system applied to the global South. And Brazil, for them, was a fabulous case because this was not a small African nation or a small nation in Southeast Asia. This was, at the time, a nation that was on the way to become the fifth largest economy in the world.
Right.
Which is what was happening during the Lula years and the beginning of the Dilma years, you know.
Right.
So, and of course, included in what the Americans always called our backyard. Because many of you probably know that the Monroe Doctrine, which is still going on since 1830, considers the whole of Latin America as the U.S. backyard. And Brazil is the top dog in Latin America. Everybody knows that, economically, geopolitically, etc. Strategically, because it controls the South Atlantic, connections with Africa, you name it. So Brazil, you cannot afford, from the point of view of the American establishment and American elites and the American financial system, to have a Brazil that is relatively sovereign. I'm not talking about completely sovereign.
Right.
And that's what it was during Lula and in the beginning of the Dilma years as well. Okay, Dilma may have committed a lot of mistakes. That's another story. But the key story is that the engineering of a soft coup, as you mentioned, which was very well disguised because it was a hardcore institutional coup against Dilma, it worked so well that it took only 2 years to have her out. And that's where we come into the Bolsonaro phenomenon, because the Bolsonaro phenomenon started the minute Dilma was re-elected in 2014. This is essential to understand what happened afterwards and why we had Bolsonaro elected as president. Four years after Dilma was re-elected and 2 years after the coup against Dilma.
So please tell us a little bit more. So we have... She's basically following in the footsteps of Lula and continuing the path. And then we see suddenly all these things happening and she's gone. And then, you know, a few years later, we have this person, which, you know, we were joking before the program, you know, I said proto-fascist, but maybe we can just say fascist.
Yes.
Suddenly becoming the president. And we see a Brazil that's basically split in half. Where you basically have 50-50 on both sides. So tell us what happened there.
I'm going to have to give you the short version it's an extremely convoluted process.
Right.
But, you know, the main lines, the guidelines of the whole thing is the success of using technicalities mostly in Congress to basically impeach Dilma.
Right.
That happened in 2016.
Right.
At the time, the military and Brazilian elites linked to the international financial system and in a very clever way, posing as sovereignists, nationalists, but anti-system in their own worlds, but in fact, defending the macro system, which is the rules-based international order, as the Americans themselves define it, right? So the military in Brazil, they pose as nationalists, and they're serving foreign elites. How they managed to pull that off tells you how sophisticated is their PR offensive and the conflicting signs that they are sending all the time, which in terms of a puzzle, mostly puzzled public opinion in Brazil, people don't, they cannot identify the signs anymore. They are completely lost in a semiotic jungle, you know, don't make absolutely lost. So they start, you know, they have a Brazilian flag where they, you know, they go out in the streets with the Brazilian flag defending a military product, which is the case of Bolsonaro, not even a general, a mere captain. And he became a captain because he was expelled from the army. And then he went up one rank, you know, a mediocre politician for 20-something years. And from one day to another, this guy is being incensed as the new salvation for the Brazilian debacle after the years of Lula and Dilma, which were demonized to the hilt, of course, especially in terms of they are extremely corrupt. They stole, of course, they could never prove that Dilma or Lula stole, were actual bank robbers on a state level. But they criminalized the Workers' Party where they came from. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are problems with the Workers' Party, but they were not a bunch of Al Capone thieves, you know.
Right.
So, but this, but the whole PR campaign, which obviously the whole infrastructure for this PR campaign was borrowed from the Americans, which have vast experience all across the global South of organizing regime change in a soft way.
Right. Yes,
and
we know.
Really hardcore regime.
Yeah, we know. Yeah, in Iran we know.
In Iran, come on, you know better than anybody in the world in Iran about that, right? So the beginning of the Bolsonaro project, it's something very interesting in terms of the timeline.
Right.
He went to a Brazilian military academy only 1 month after Dilma was reelected. That was the end of 2014. She was reelected in November. In December, he went to this military academy and more or less informally launched a bid for the presidency in 2018.
Right.
And of course, the whole military brass was behind him. So he became, from day one, literally, their candidate for the next elections four years later. And that's exactly what happened this 4 years later, because in between we had the crucial plank of the whole scheme, let's put it this way, which was to demonize and marginalize Lula, preferably forever. And that's how they concocted this absolutely bogus allegations that
so,
Lula
So, excuse me, Pepe. So, in other words, they realized that if Lula is there, he would not be able to be elected because they would be facing a formidable opponent who's popular,
They were afraid that if Lula would run in 2018, they would win. And in fact, all the polls were saying that if Lula runs in 2018, this is after the coup against Dilma. Every poll was saying he's going to win, and he was going
to
win.
Exactly. So in other words, they had to get rid of her. They had to get rid of Dilma, bring in some sort of an interim until 2018, some sort of a, you know.
The interim was the horrible Temer administration. Right. Temer was the center-right vice president of Dilma.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Pepe Escobar? Contrary to the stereotypical image most have of Brazil, this geostrategically very important nation is in fact a socially and culturally deeply divided nation. The powerful US-backed army and traditional economic elites are still not fully capable of accepting that the majority of the poorer population in that country has gained significant political power after the end of the US-backed military dictatorship. This reality being most clearly manifested in the recent election victory and now third presidential term of former labor leader Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. In addition to this domestic state of affairs, Brazil is one of the key countries in the shaping of a new post-American multipolar world, being one of the founders of the BRICS Forum alongside Russia, India, and China. A forum which will experience further expansion in the near future with the addition of strategically important countries such as Iran, Argentina, Algeria, and Turkey. The next few years will show whether Brazil is capable of participating in the emergence of a new multipolar world as one of the new emerging global powers, or whether the US-backed Brazilian military and traditional economic elites will keep Brazil within the US sphere of influence by any means necessary. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. In the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nisa, Ayah 32, we read, "Do not covet the advantage which Allah has given some of you over others. To men belongs a share of what they have earned, and to women a share of what they have earned. And ask Allah for His bounty. Indeed, Allah has knowledge of all things." We have so many narrations in Islam emphasizing the point that open relation between opposite genders is forbidden, especially between non-mahrams. In other words, Islam has some etiquettes for the relation between men and women when in party, market, or workplace. The only open and warm relation between men and women accepted by Islam is that of wife and husband. The beauty and body of a wife is only allowed to be shown to a husband and not the stranger man in public. The warm relation between opposite genders in the society establishes cold relation between the spouses inside the house. Chastity and honor of men and women is the best solution for strengthening family bond in the society. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about our program on Call of Islam page, IRIB English Radio, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IR.